Tonight, we're going to be talking about religious liberty. And what I'd like you to do is just, I'm going to make an opening comment, some opening comments, and then we're going to talk mostly about the central paragraph right there. If you look at it, it basically says, religious liberty is more than freedom of worship. It includes our ability to make our contribution to the common good of all Americans without having to compromise our faith. If you wanted to see the central core of what we're going to be talking about, it's that sentence. Now, what I'd like to begin with is by taking a little time to deconstruct that sentence. Basically, just to diagram it and to talk about its implications. So let's begin. I'm going to go, maybe, Scott, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. But this is an extremely important issue. First of all, religious liberty is more than freedom of worship. What does that mean? You see, freedom of worship is different from freedom of religion. What's the difference? Freedom of worship means that you don't have a government that interferes with you gathering together on Sunday or Saturday, the Sabbath, and expressing your faith in God and worshiping in whatever manner you so choose. So, in the United States, we have freedom of worship. No government, and please understand, that's no small thing, because let me give you, for example, in Saudi Arabia, you don't have freedom of worship. Christians are not allowed to gather in churches. You're not allowed to. And so the very, and I don't know if you've been going to church here lately, you've been seeing how right during the time of the prayer of the faithful, there's the prayer for the Christian martyrs. Because, and I say, every time I celebrate Mass, people are dying for the very thing that we are doing in a comforting, air-conditioned space every Sunday morning. If you live in places in the world, not only do you risk your life for being a Christian, you also risk it when you come to worship. Because the church that you may be attending may be bombed, or the doors may be locked and the building set on fire. It's been happening all around the world. Okay, so, when we're talking about freedom of worship is basically the ability to gather with people whom you choose to worship God in a manner in which you choose. Okay? So, now, look at the next part. Well, let me just back up a little bit. I want to put a little emphasis on the word worship, because for me, the etymology of the word worship, in other words, the word history of the word worship, says a whole bunch about what we're doing on Sunday and its relationship to the rest of the week. The word worship is really a very simple word. It's made up of two parts, W-O-R, and then the last, S-H-I-P. Now, the suffix ship is basically the practice or art of anything. So, for example, you can have penmanship. You can have artisanship. What are some of the other ships?
Relationship.
Authorship. It's whenever you practice anything, ship is the art of practicing whatever you're practicing. What would W-O-R be? Worth. 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 Now, what would that make the word worship mean? When you gather on Sundays, what you're doing is you are setting the hierarchy of the things that are worthwhile to you in their proper order. That's why when a teacher used to say, practice your penmanship, they would want you to practice writing. Well, practicing worship or worshiping means that you come together with people of like mind and you are saying, these are the things that are worthwhile in our lives and we are setting them in their correct order. Okay? So when you worship God, what you're saying, in effect, is you are the highest worth. And I put the values that your son taught me as the top worthwhile thing in my life. That's what worship means. Now, that's why in the Old Testament, I think it's in Isaiah or one of the Psalms, where the Bible says, this people worships me with their mouths, but their hearts are far from me. So, freedom of worship is not a light thing, because what you're actually saying, you're coming together with a group that has the same faith that you do, and it doesn't mean that we all think the same, but what we're saying is our core values, our core worth starts with this. And of course, God is first. Okay? So, notice then that religious liberty is more than just setting up your worship. I always call it my worship hierarchy. I teach a lot about my worship hierarchy, because my worship hierarchy, as many people know, is God first, people second. What's third?
Apples.
And what's fourth?
Starbucks.
Okay. The first two are actually true. Okay? The third is a little off. Okay? But God is always first. And Jesus was very clear about that. He was saying, if your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your boyfriend, your girlfriend is more important than me, you're not worthy of me. Notice the word worthy. Okay? What Jesus is saying is, we have to have him as the highest, being his disciples, as the highest worth of our lives. And that's what the biggest, the number one is, that religious freedom, however, is more than freedom of worship. What is it? What is religious freedom? The next sentence. It includes, but it's not only, but it includes, and listen to this sentence, our ability to make our contribution, now, to the common good. To make our contribution to the common good. Now, let me finish that sentence because it's all one. It includes our ability to make our contribution to the common good of all Americans without having to compromise our faith. Now, what is the common good of all Americans? Now, this is what immediately, when we want, as Catholics, to make our contribution to the common good, what's the first thing we get hit with? Separation of church and state. Now, Civil War. It makes the words flow. Notice that immediately when we, now, who is we? We are Catholics. Okay? We gather together in a community of faith, and we are different. We're not saying everybody in the world or in the United States shares our vision of what ought to be the highest good. We have a point of view that the highest good is a particular form. Okay? What happens is that a lot of time people will invoke the separation of church and state to say, you ought not to contribute to the vision of the common good, because your vision of the common good comes from religious principles. And therefore, since your vision of the common good comes from religious principles, and we believe in the separation of church and state, therefore, your contribution to the vision of the common good is excluded from common dialogue. And what we're saying is that we hold to the separation of church and state, but do not interpret the separation of church and state as being the separation of religion from public life. Because religion has its specific place in public life, especially in the United States. From the very beginning, the United States was founded on a particular religious vision. Now, what the founders rejected was the imposition of a particular church on the state. Where did that come from? It comes from the experience of England. In England, the English monarch was in charge of the state, and the state had an official church. For in England, and Scott is really an expert on this, but in England, for many centuries, it was illegal to be Catholic. And not only was it illegal to be Catholic, you could be killed for being Catholic. And so when the founding members came to the United States, in this new country, this new England, okay, they basically were saying, we do not want to have a church that is imposed upon all of the people who will be living in these states. And so we want a separation, and that's it's from a philosopher by the name of, I'm blanking out right now. But it's a philosopher who said there should be a separation from religion and faith. I mean, from religion and the state. Okay? But there was never, and there has never been, a separation of religion and public life. What is public life? It's the life that we live together as a whole. Do you remember the first few sentence, one of the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence?
Were you trying to think of John Locke?
John Locke, thank you. Remember, in the Declaration of Independence, the second sentence, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Okay? Now, when it says we, what makes we, we? Notice what it starts. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What constitutes the we? Yeah, it's people, but what constitutes we? Because there are other we. Evidently, when you say we, we're different from them. What makes we us? And you know what it is? We, and then comes, hold these truths. In other words, we belong to a group. And the group holds these truths together. The group holds these truths together. And what are those truths? That all men are created equal. Immediately, you're in religion. Immediately. From the very beginning, we is established as a common people who hold a group of truths. And where do they get those truths? From the Old Testament. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What's another word for self-evident? Faith. Obvious. In other words, what the Declaration is already saying is, we have faith in these propositions. And what are they? That all men are created equal. Where did that come from? It doesn't come from pagan religion. Because pagan religion does not hold that all people are created equal. In India, there are caste systems. In all kinds of different places, there are tribal preferences. That all men are created equal is already a Judeo-Christian understanding of humanity. And that they are endowed by their creator. A creator is an explicit understanding of reality of God from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that among these rights that they are endowed with by the creator, notice who is the one that's giving the rights to people? It's not the state. The state is not giving the rights. It's the creator that is giving us the rights. And that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What I want you to see primarily is, from the beginning, you already have religion in public life. You don't have the imposition of state, but you do have religion in public life. But there's no question that the United States of America is already founded on biblical principles. And what are we saying? We want the ability to be in the dialogue, to make our contribution It may not, you may not agree with our contribution, but we, the religious people of the United States, have a right to participate in making the contribution to the common good of all Americans. And what we're asking is that we be allowed to do that without having to compromise our beliefs. That's basically, and the second part of it is more than freedom of worship. It is what is called freedom of religion. Freedom of religion is the ability to make our contribution to the common good of all Americans without having to compromise our Catholic faith. So, what we're doing then is, what the Catholic Church is not only the Catholic Church, gosh, is Jewish, our brother, Jewish brothers and sisters, different faith groups are interested in, is we want to participate in the dialogue about how life ought to be in our country. And we have a right to do so, and we want to make that contribution to the dialogue without having to compromise our faith.
Father, son, drink some wine. I'm going to read him a bedtime story. Okay?
Got it.
All right. You know you're on very thin ice when you begin quoting Baptists to Catholics. But there's somebody you need to know about. And his name is Dr. Albert Moeller. And he is the dean or the president of the Southern Baptist Seminary in Kentucky. And I wish he could be here tonight. He could certainly add much to our conversation. I read him regularly. You remember when there was a very large brouhaha about the law in Indiana that would not allow a Christian baker to not bake a wedding cake?
Yes.
Now, by the way, there is a halal meat market right down the street here.
It's a Muslim meat market.
Yeah, I went in there a couple nights ago and ordered 4 pork chops, and he didn't have any problem at all throwing me out the door. Think about it. Think about it. Do we force him to serve Gentiles, Goyim, Christians, pork chops? It's against his religion, so he doesn't have to carry it. Think about it. Hang on to it. Go to your favorite Jewish butcher, asking if you can get a pork roast. And if he throws you out the door, go see if you can get anybody to back you up on that one. All right. This was an article that Albert Moeller wrote, and I'm just going to pick a couple of things from it. He's talking about an editorial in the New York Times written by a man by the name of Frank Bruni, B-R-U-N-I. That influential paper has appointed itself the guardian of civil liberties, and it has championed the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual causes for decades now. But the paper's editorial board condemned the Indiana law as cover for bigotry. The most chilling statement in the editorial, however, was this: the freedom to exercise one's religion is not under assault in Indiana or anywhere else in this country, Father. Religious people, including Christians, who continue to make up the majority of Americans, may worship however they wish and say whatever they like. There you see religious liberty cut down to freedom to worship. He says, we no longer have religious liberty. We have freedom to worship 1 hour, or if it's a mass that you're presiding, an hour and a half, of your liking on Saturday night, Sunday morning, or Sunday afternoon. Religious liberty has been reduced to what you do for 1 hour a week. Let me find one other that I want to catch right here. But the clearest evidence of the eagerness of the secular left to reduce and redefine religious liberty comes in the form of two columns by opinion writer Frank Bruni. The first, published in January, included Bruni's assurance that he affirmed, quote, the right of people to believe what they do and say what they wish in their pews, homes, and hearts. Quote, close quote. Religious liberty, Moeller says, is now redefined so that it has no place in the public arena. No place outside pews, homes, and hearts. Religious liberty no longer has any public significance.
And that's what we're arguing about. What we're saying is, all that we want to do as Catholics is be free to make our contribution to society, our common society, and to make it as Catholics. We're not saying that you have to agree with us. You don't have to agree with us. But isn't that what political dialogue is all about? About people dialoguing on things that they don't necessarily agree and making their contribution to that particular, to the particular dialogue. Now, you might say, what are some of the issues that are at hand? I just was thinking about it this afternoon. But I want you to think through how society is changing, especially for us. One would be, and I'm just going to say these very quickly, the definition of human life. When does human life begin? I was talking about this with a friend of mine. And these are issues that have tremendous consequences. For example, if you work in a hospital that receives public funds and you're a doctor, and if you're a gynecologist, should you be forced by that hospital to perform abortions? Because if you don't, the hospital risks losing public funding. And so a lot of doctors, and I know of a couple of nurses, who have gotten into tremendous trouble because they did not want to participate in that procedure. Not only that, but suicide ought human life. Ought we, as a people, to say we ought to have public access to suicide on demand? Not only suicide on demand, but I was reading an article on something called The Duty to Die. You may have never heard of The Duty to Die. But the duty to die is when you get too sick and your disease is too expensive to treat, and you ought to have a duty not to impose that upon the public. And therefore, what we see happen is that people are being pushed into saying, by the insurance company, by the way, we don't want to pay for your care, but we will pay for your suicide. Do we as Catholics have anything to say about that? Do we as Christians can participate in the answer that the state gives, that insurance companies give? Or are we excluded by the fact that we are a church? By the very fact that we are a church, are we excluded from participating in the dialogue which will answer that question? It's a big issue. I don't know if there's any others that you want to bring up. I have.
How about chaplains in the military? If a man or a woman, but we're Catholics, a man is a Catholic chaplain in the military and speaks publicly about the fact that we as Catholics understand homosexual behavior, not orientation, behavior as disordered, he could be court-martialed. Because that does not agree with openly living when we did away with don't ask, don't tell.
So we're going to go to questions now, and I want you to remember these are controversial issues, okay? Very controversial issues. But we're not arguing for anything other than we would like, as Catholics, to be able to participate in the dialogue which will form. Remember what Aristotle had a great definition for politics. Aristotle said, very simple, what is politics? It answers one question: how ought we to live together? How ought we to live together? What are the rules that should govern how we live together? Okay? All we're saying is we want a seat at the table where those decisions are being discussed, and we want to participate as Catholics and be allowed to voice our opinions. Period. Are we going to agitate and to try and push the lever to go our way? You betcha. You betcha. But so is everybody else. And that's what politics is all about. Okay?